The actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI. An engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
I'm Candy Shannon, host of Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Olive Senior. Olive Senior is the award-winning author of 20 books of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and children's literature. She was the Poet Laureate of Jamaica from 2021 to 2024. Her new novel is Paradise Once. How are you doing today, Olive?
I'm wonderful. Thank you.
And how are things in Jamaica?
Yeah. Hot.
Okay.
Sunny.
Yeah. Well, I want to congratulate you. You've written a fascinating book and many questions I want to ask you about it. Let's begin by talking about the indigenous people of the Caribbean before the coming of the Europeans. Who were these people and why did you decide to write a novel about them?
Okay, well, there were a number of people on the Caribbean islands. In the north, there were the people we call the Taino. In the south, there were the people that Columbus and others called the Carib. Today, they're known as the Kalinago in Dominica. And it is believed they all came from Central America, the Orinoco region. They were boat people, so they traveled by boat from Central America all the way up and people the different Caribbean islands. So the people I'm concerned with, the Taino, were in the what we call the Greater Antilles, the larger islands, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Jamaica, Cuba, and the Bahamas, in that part of the Caribbean. And they were the people that Columbus first encountered when he arrived in 1492. Mm-hmm. My interest in this, and my book is about the fact that they didn't long survive the so-called discovery, that encounter. My novel is set within two generations of Columbus's arrival and the introduction of Europeans to the island, the decimation of the islands. And already there were so few Taino left that they had begun to import enslaved Africans for the workforce. So that gives you an idea of the type of genocide that took place. Mm-hmm. So my interest springs from the fact that I'm a Jamaican. We were told in our school books that Columbus met these primitive little people who vanished.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about. I was growing up. When did you hear these stories? I mean, we talk about the classroom. Did you hear anything about that in your house in terms of family members, grandparents?
No, not in terms of my house. Mm-hmm. And we just knew there were these little people called Arawaks. The British call them Arawaks. And we didn't really know anything about them, although it's in later years I'm now learning that there are people in Jamaica and on the islands who identified, mm-hmm. As Arawaks.
When did you decide to write this novel? It seems like that this might have been years in the making.
Yes. Well, I got interested in research in the Taino on my own with no intention of writing a novel as such, just because I wanted to know. The more I learned about them and the fact that we had inherited so much culturally from them, quite apart from the fact of blood, there's this cultural inheritance and even words like hurricane, canoe, etc. I started doing research, which is what I do when I'm interested in anything, And so I've spent, I would say, easily the last four decades doing research on the Taino, the indigenous people of the Caribbean and where they came from and so on. And at first I wrote a lot of poems based on their mythology. And so the novel was a late thing because I'd accumulated so much material. I thought, what am I going to do with this? So I've been trying for many years to write a novel, and I finally found a way into it.
Let's talk about your research, because I'm wondering in terms of when you go to, like, say, the different islands, are certain things kept in better conditions than other? Or, for example, did you go to Cuba and things were in Spanish and you had to look at navigate the different languages?
Yeah. Well, I didn't travel for this book to do my research, you know, because I'm looking at the work of scholars. There are books out there now. And just almost every day there's a new article published. There's a kind of growth industry. I've traveled for my other research. For instance, I did a book on the building of the Panama Canal and the West Indian contribution, and I spent a lot of time in Panama there. So, and that research also was in the archives in Jamaica and other countries. Whereas for this book, I've been doing it mostly through existing research, secondary research, but there's a lot of that. There's a lot of scholarship on it.
Talk about the names of your characters in Paradise Once. You've got Night Orchard, you've got Shark Tooth, you've got Flint, you've got Feather, Candlewood, Heart of Palm. Talk about these names.
Yeah, well, you know, the names just came to up when I formulated the characters.
So you made up these names.
Rhymed with their names, and which were very appropriate. But, you know, naming in this society, in these indigenous societies, is very important. Your name is bestowed to you by the, in a religious kind of way. But the names of people, for the most part, was based on either words derived from nature, you know, trees, plants, or a prediction about the, you know, the path of this particular person, what the medicine man saw. But in a way, the names sort of came to me naturally. I'm not sure that I changed any of them.
Well, let me put you on the spot. Who named you Olive?
Well, I don't even know. My parents had 10 children, so I guess they were going through the alphabet. So then once I had an idea of who the characters were, then they arrived fully blown. They arrived with their names, their characteristics, and so on.
Did these names of characters drive the novels that they took over, and all of a sudden you realize because this character has a name, he or she will do something different in the novel, or did you control
I think they arrived with their name, you know, like Heart of Palm was always Heart of Palm. I never changed any of the names. So I had to imagine each character. They arrived and they sort of settled in my brain. They took up lodgings in myself and I lived with them literally. So
took up lodging. What are they renting or did they buy a house?
I think they bought a house because although the book is done, it's as if they're still alive. They're still out there and the readers are discovering them, you know?
Did you have these characters talking in your head to each other?
Yeah. Everything that happens in the novel is happening in my head, which is how I think you write fiction. You know, I'm visualizing them, I'm seeing them, I'm hearing them, I'm seeing their interactions, because I can't write a novel that's alive if they're not alive in my head, in my mind. So, while I'm writing the book, while I'm thinking about them, yeah, they're very much alive. They're like human beings that I know.
Well, let's go back to something you said earlier in this conversation, Olive Senior. You mentioned that some of these ideas came to you in poems. So now I'm looking at the fact that you write in a number of genres, you know, determines a poem, what determines children's books, you know. I think of where some of these names would be exciting for children's books.
Yes, yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but I mean, in a way, this could be a young adult book because the characters are young. They're what we would call teenagers. That's not a term they use. And in my children's book, I hadn't thought of the names, but I do love to use words that are new and have sound effects like bununus. You know, I have a book called bununus hair. That's a Jamaican term. And I find kids love that. Kids love to read and hear words that are strange and have resonance. So maybe I'll think about about that in terms.
Well, talking about words, Oliver Sr., you have a glossary in the back of your book of about 94 words. How difficult was it to incorporate certain words into your storytelling, and how would this novel read differently if these terms were not used?
Yeah, well, I deliberately use the terms because I think that brings home to the reader, that helps to bring home the culture. I wanted to say to the people, these weren't just these little primitive people portrayed visually as well as in books that were had these tiny little huts living out there making little pots. This was a very sophisticated society, and they had their own language, because the language of the Taino, it is based on, these languages are based on Arawak, which is a group that still exists in Guyana and the mainland. But the language evolved as a distinct language as they, over maybe thousands of years. But the Taino that we have is coming to us through Spanish. Because a lot of the research is, or a lot of what we know is what the Spanish wrote about that encounter with these people called the Taino. So a lot of the words we already know. We already knew. We just didn't know the source. As I mentioned, canoe, huracan, hurricane, cassava, bami, we eat every morning in Jamaica from yucca. Which was their bread, and so on. So we already knew a lot of these words. And in fact, reading the research, these words jump out at you. But in fact, there are now quite a number of dictionaries of Taino, because there's been a resurgence of Taino culture, and they're interested in writing the words. In the orthography, which brings out the Taino pronunciation and so on. So it wasn't difficult for me. I already was familiar with a lot of the words.
Did you have to concern yourself with the actual spelling? Did you find certain, there were different spellings of a certain word, and you had to decide which one you wanted to use?
And that is, there's an argument going on about that. So what I have used is the most recent advice about spelling, which is to spell in a way that the words would have been actually pronounced. So canoe or canoa is normally written with a C. The recommendation in my book is spelled with a K, it's a hard K, and so on. So the way the words are written in my book and the most modern approach to it changes the spelling somewhat. Like Zemi is usually spelled with a Z, but now it's spelled with a C because it's a soft sound, and so on. So the spelling is reflecting more closely the pronunciation.
Let's look at the story, Olive Senior. This novel begins with trade, culture interacting. Talk about how trade changes things. That's the key way that people begin to interact.
Yes, excuse me. And I also wanted to make the point that the people of the Caribbean were master boat people, and the sea is what drove everything. So these indigenous people of the Caribbean were connected not just with each other on the islands, but they were connected with Central and South America. And for all we know, although there's very little evidence with North American tribes, because Cuba is very close to Miami, as we know. So therefore, trade, inter-island contacts were very important. It was happening. It was more easy, I think, for a Jamaican Taino to get to, I don't know, Mexico than it is for us today. Flying, So I wanted to emphasize that these were seaborne societies. The Taino had canoes bigger than Columbus's flagship, and they were moving around all the time. And part of that movement was about trade. So people were trading what they had for things they needed. So they'd go to the Caicos to get salt, or they'd sell bird feathers. Jamaicans were selling bird feathers to Mexico, etc. So trade is, I think, drove a lot of these connections, these inter-island connections. And the trade routes were disrupted, of course, when the Spaniards arrived. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, it is emphasizing the disruption that took place in these societies.
Let's look at how you, as Alice Senior, how you're balancing. You talk about the destruction, okay? To what extent are you concerned about the politics of your novel versus the individual characters in terms of just being characters and not necessarily being, you know, making decisions, not knowing what the politics are?
Well, if what do you call politics, I think, would be the religious... The religious overtures. I mean, these were societies that were very spiritual, mm-hmm. and the higher spirits dictated every movement that they made. So even though these were young people, they would be aware of the spiritual. Even though they themselves were not necessarily aware that they had been chosen to undertake a journey, you know, to carry out an important spiritual journey. When you talk about the politics, if you mean what is happening with the Spaniards, the people in this village had not yet encountered the Spaniards. But because there was all the movement around, they knew what was happening, what had been happening in the other islands. So they were moved both by curiosity, but also by fear and anxiety and so on. I don't know if that really answers your question.
Well, you also have, you're writing a novel, mm-hmm. and as you said, you sort of make up an island. But what happens is that there are some factual people that will pop up in your text.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Talk about how you balance that.
Oh yeah, so the my narrative starts with a massacre of a Cuban village, which is an actual historical account, and in my author's note at the back of the book, I explain why I chose that I had to write about that. That had to be the start of my book, but there are historic characters who were present at that. It was led by troops from Jamaica who came over to support. The peopling, the taking of Cuba, that is what it really was, by Spanish forces. But Las Casas, who, if you know anything mm-hmm. at all of the history of the Caribbean and so on, plays a major role in this history. He was the priest that was present mm-hmm. at that massacre, and it was that massacre that turned him around and made him the so-called protector of the Indians and so on. So there are a lot of historical figures that I mention throughout the novel, because we know who the Spaniards were, you know,
right.
their chronicles. We know their names, we know who they were. So I felt it's important to locate people in this historical moment, to show them what was happening, give them timelines, dates, and so on, because this novel is really about the meeting of two worlds.
Right.
You know, it's a meeting of the old world, Europe, and the first meeting, the first encounter with the so-called new world, the Americas.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I wanted you to read a passage from chapter 5, because mm-hmm. it shows you that coming together of the two people. Could you read that for us?
Yes, and I should just add that the critical spiritual moment for the people in the village that was destroyed, or it is believed, the introduction of a foreign object that was really challenging their own spiritual practices. So Feather, I should mention, is the trader who arrives in this village. When Feather huffed and puffed his way up the steep hill into the village and stopped to catch his breath and look around, he was most surprised to see the new cacique seated among the crowd milling about in the plaza in front of the cane. In the past, Run Swiftly would have had a silly grin on his face, but now he sat straight and unsmiling, his powerful chest thrust forward, so that the one-in pectoral glistened golden against his skin. Approaching him, Feather carefully laid down his pack. He raised his palms and bowed all the way to the ground in greeting. The cacique nodded and signaled for refreshments to be brought. Feather unpacked his offerings. Flint saw it as soon as the trader opened the basket. First, the baleful eye staring at him. The crown, the claws on the one foot that it flexed. And last of all, the feathers, glowing iridescent red and gold, shimmering and glinting in the colors of sun. There were audible gasps at the auspicious colors as Feather lifted the strange bird on high so everyone could see it before placing it on the ground. The bird staggered a bit, then, righting itself, hopped inside the semicircle of onlookers, lifted its wings and flapped. And then, to everyone's amazing, it raised its head and emitted from its throat the most astonishing sounds ever heard from a bird. Cock-a-doodle-doo, over and over in varying tones. Cock-a-doodle-doo. People clutched their amulets and backed away, and the timid screamed and fled. As if pleased with the effect it had, the bird lowered its head and pecked at the handful of maize Feather had placed on the ground, nodding before swallowing each corn grain. Though its angry eyes never wavered, it allowed Feather to pick it up, hold it under its arm, and stroke it before he bowed again and offered it to the cacique. Run swiftly nodded, and his assistant, Dark Water, stepped forward and received the bird in his arms. He too tried to stroke it, as he would a parrot or a dove, but the bird suddenly exploded and scratched him, its claws leaving bloody marks on his cheeks and chest. Dark Water gasped and let go of the bird, which fell to the ground and skittered about, its wings flapping. Those nearest backed away, though the braver ones laughed as a trader did. The cacique had not moved a muscle. He looked questioningly at the trader. This is the bird of the morning of which I have heard? Yes, the ones brought by the panals to rouse them from their hamacas. Their holy men do not do that? No, Guama. By this time, the trader had taken hold of the bird again, and he was stooping in the circle, the bird on his knee. He was stroking it and feeding it corn kernels. The bird closed its eyes and seemed calmer. Its feathers became luminous as sun climbed high enough to send its rays to strike the plaza. Feather knew just how to grab and hold the attention of the crowd. He was speaking to the cacique, but now he raised his voice. This is the bird they use to pull sun from its watery bed every morning. See its red crown, see its wattle, see it dressed in colors of sun. Everyone looked, for although the village, the entire world was filled with beautiful birds, they had never seen one like this. Many in their hearts thought their own sunbird, the macaw, was far more beautiful, and nothing could compare with Colibri, the hummingbird, but he was one of the sacred powers. But all could feel this bird bursting with power too, the power of the other, the ones who had come from far.
You were listening to Olive's senior reading from her novel, Paradise Warmth. Thank you for that reading. You know, you talk about how, you know, something comes in and changes the culture. And I thought about the old movie, The God Must Be Crazy, you know, where a Coke bottle falls from the sky and it changes the entire African culture.
Exactly. Yes. This is one of the things as a novelist and as a human being, I wonder how I'm looking at the novel is from the Taíno perspective. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I wonder about is, how do they feel when these strange beings arrive? And is it how we would feel if Martians landed in our cornfield? You know, and to me, it's both, you're frightened, you're in awe, but you're also curious. And I tried to convey this kind of mixture, because at first, the Taino, we believe, did not have sails on their boats. They paddled. And so these boats with these white sails filled with the wind suddenly arriving on the horizon, the first thing was they thought there were birds from the skies. You know, you can see that image. And so I tried to convey this, this strangeness of this. And of course, a Taino would have been extremely strange to the Spaniards too, you know. So that is something that I still think about, what it was like. What would it be like for us today if aliens suddenly arrived?
You know? Well, you know, I also looked at the title of your book, Paradise Once, and I immediately thought of Milton's Paradise Lost, where, you know, you have this epic poem where you have this sense of a fall, you know, from grace. Does that tie in with the spiritual aspect? We'll talk a little bit more about that. This whole sort of this fall from this paradise.
Well,
you being kicked out of the or being dragged out of the paradise.
In a sense. But what I was really thinking about more is Columbus did say this was, when he sailed to the Caribbean, it was so extraordinary and beautiful. This is the earthly paradise. He wrote back to the king and queen of Spain saying that. So in a way, my title, of course, is ironic. But these islands, if you think about it, were paradise in the sense that they were... the native peoples were not challenged by hunger, by they were secure, they were no large animals. There were animals to hunt, but not to harm them. There was no food scarcity. They talk about the abundance. You could just walk to the sea and see the fish almost, the rivers. There was no food scarcity there. They were threatened occasionally by hurricanes. Occasionally, the Carib, so-called Carib from the south, raided, but they also traded and intermarried. So these were people on these islands that were extremely secure in every way. And the Spaniards were amazed at how healthy they were, how beautiful their bodies were. They ate well. And so they had time to create a very sophisticated society because they had leisure. So they created beautiful art. They had their spiritual practices, their rules for social living, and so on. So to me, that is a kind of paradise because they were not threatened. There were no threats to them, and so they could feel secure in this space. And suddenly, paradise is invaded. They're murdered. The treatment of them was alien to everything that they knew. And so to me, that is Paradise Lost in a way. But also one of the things is the loss of the environmental disaster that then occurred following European occupation of these islands.
So, well, you know, along with the occupation, along with the environment, if I was reading your book, it seems that because of especially Night Orchard, this book is woman-centered. It's about a woman coming, a young girl coming of age. And when I look at that, she's coming of age at a time when an old world is ending and perhaps a new world is being created.
Yes. Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of Night Orchard like that. But you are right. And it's interesting that the main characters who carry the novel forward are young. They're all teenagers. Or Night Orchard is about 11. You know, they're very young people. And I didn't want this to end on the sad note, which is, it's a sad story. Because out of this, the young, mainly young people of the Caribbean, took to the mountains along with runaway Africans to form maroon societies, which exist to this day in countries like Jamaica. So in a way, yes, it is a time of the old world arrived and I guess killed off what what would have been old in this society. And yes.
But we'll use that as a way of ending half of our show and then beginning it up. So we're gonna talk about the new world after we just have a little break. My guest this morning is Olive Senior. We're talking about her novel Paradise Once. My name's Ethelbert Miller, the station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, August 25th, 2025. Thursday, August 28th, from 7 to 9 p.m., Africa World Now Project and Bloom Bars present the film Franz Fanon, His Life, His Struggle, His Work by Sheikh Jamai, 3222 11th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., to commemorate Black August and Franz Fanon's 100th year. Information at bloombars.com. Thursday, August 28th, from 4 to 8 p.m., community organizations and unions across the region are coming together to stand up against D.C. occupation and mass firings for a Labor Day rally and Solidarity Day march. Sponsoring organizations include the Metro Washington Council, AFL-CIO, representing 150,000 working people in the DMV, Free DC, DC Jobs with Justice, and many more. The rally starts at DuPont Circle, 1610 Connecticut Avenue Northwest. For more info, contact media at dclabor.org. From Thursday, August 28th through Friday, August 29th, the Black Farm Community Supported Agriculture Program will have fresh, locally sourced produce from Black, Brown, women-owned, and values-aligned farms with the intention of supporting healthy communities and sustainable agriculture by providing access to nutritious local fruits and vegetables. More info, visit diversecityfund.org or dolegrocery.org. Friday, August 29th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa will hold a book event titled Child of Congo, Where It All Began, with poetry reading from author Lauren, exploring identity, conflict, and resilience through the lens of Congo's untold history. Located on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit Sankofa.com. Sunday, August 31st from 1 to 6 p.m., the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, the Black Alliance for Peace, Pan-African Community Action, the Vaughn 17 Campaign, the All-African People's Revolutionary Party, and Books and Bouquets will be hosting D.C. Curb Fest for political prisoners to commemorate Black August and uplift the ongoing struggle to free our political prisoners at 1 DC, the Black Workers and Wellness Center in Anacostia. Visit bit.ly/curbfest for more information. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Olive Senior, and we're talking about her new novel, Paradise Once. Just before we took our break, Olive, you mentioned the Maroons. Talk about your character, Sekou.
Yeah. Sekou is an African born in Spain, and he sold at a very young age and travels, you know, he's well-traveled, ends up in Jamaica with his third or fourth owner, who happens to be the man who leads the military forces from Jamaica to Cuba and the attack on the village. So Sekou arrives with them, but part of his thing is he just takes it for granted that he's a Spaniard. You know, he's his parents, of course, are African, but his upbringing so far has not enabled him to discover his true identity. So throughout the course of the novel, by the end, you know, I think he's one of those characters who has really changed and he knows who he is. But I wanted an African character in it because by this time, he's not part of the enslaved who were brought as enslaved people to work the plantations that were being established. He has a different status, etc. So in a way, he evolved as a character, but he then identifies with the Taino after the massacre, and he becomes a part of the journey to the end of the book, and he. To be honest, when I first wrote him into the book, I didn't know much about him. He's one of those characters that sort of all evolved as we went along, you know. And in fact, when I finished the book, I had to go back and write the last piece about him and his journey to identity. So the Taino characters I knew. I lived with them for a long time. Saku arrived and evolved and developed as he went along. But I felt it was important to emphasize from the start the African presence in this world, along with the European and the Taino, these three people.
Well, let me mention something which I saw as also taking place in this novel, using the same character. I saw him being linked to the sword. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Which is key to the destruction of the society. But he doesn't use the sword.
Right.
You know, but you can see that for, you know, that perhaps a sword is something that the Thanos will have to master if they're going to at least be able to survive in the future. But I always thought that he was like the sword bearer. You know?
He's a sword bearer, but the sword is more symbolic than anything else. Because at the end, something used by the Spaniards is important to the, you know, to the ending of the story. So yeah, he is a sword bearer, and he's proud of his. He starts off being very proud of his sword, his accoutre, everything related to Spanish culture, because he thinks of himself as a Spaniard. But as it progresses, we realize that he uses a sword to cut his way through the bush, because he throws away the cross, the silver cross of the Lord, because the Christianity. And so to him, the sword, though, is more symbolic than anything else.
But not giving the story away. His story gets a little like stolen from him. That's a crisis.
And he's very upset. Yeah. And he does teach he teaches swordsmanship.
Right.
But in fact, the sword doesn't really feature in Maroon culture. Because, you know, they had their own weapons and so on. So to me, the sword is representative of the invaders. It could have been something, some other object, but the sword is significant in that way.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk about what I think is the importance of your book, okay? Your book in many places is magical. Talk about the people who exist before the Taino. Talk about the power of myths and how they connect people with nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the indigenous people of the Caribbean, I think everywhere else, didn't see the kind of separation between the human and the natural world that we see today. You know, mm-hmm. we have separated ourselves. You know, the world existed, the living and the dead were still connected, and nature was part of everyday life. And by nature, I mean plants, trees, birds, whatever existed out there. And so every human being born had a connection with nature. Even the names of the characters are related. Everyone had a protective animal, you know, whether it was a bird and so on. So that operated at that level. But nature was respected totally. You wouldn't cut anything or do anything without acknowledging that this was a living thing. So the mythology of the Taino also talks about how elements of nature brought about brought to humans the things that they needed. So for example, I talk about the role played by birds. Or the fact that the yucca is the main zeme, their main is called yuccahuna, because he controlled the growth of the yucca. It couldn't take place without his intervention. I talk about the great mother, who in the mythology was a turtle. You know, there were four human twins at the start of the world, and one that they mated with a turtle woman. And this is a foundation of the human race. So
you're saying I'm a turtle is what you're saying?
Well, you'd live very long. You live forever.
Well, Alessio, I'm glad you mentioned it because I want you to talk about Candlewood, and you have him at the end of this book talking about, as you already know, three worlds were created and destroyed before our own. The fourth age, the time of divinity, the time of the creator. You go on to explain this. And so talk about Candlewood and this passage that's at the end of the book that sort of sums up how the world exists.
Yeah. Well, Candlewood is a medicine man or a behike, or people would say a shaman or a shaman or however it's pronounced. And he was next to the cacique. Every village, the cacique was a chief. He was the most important personage because he controls the spiritual life of everyone, as we see. And he's also is a keeper of the history, which is mythological. So the history of the Taino and other indigenous people in the Americas is that there was our world is just the last of several worlds that have been created and then destroyed because of some indignity that had been imposed. It wasn't perfect. Then a new world was, and then our world. And it is a shaman's duty to preserve the integrity of this world and to protect humans and to chastise those who cross the lines and so on. So he is the most important figure in the village, but also in the book, because he mediates between the worlds as well. And because of his shamanic qualities, he can fly between worlds. So he goes into trance and he consults his emis, the spiritual entities, as to what is the best thing to do in this particular case, as he does. So he is the man or who connects the worlds, the human world, with the spiritual, with the world of the ancestors, with the world of nature, because he has been trained how to communicate with these worlds.
Hmm. But talking about communicating these worlds, women writers play a very important role, especially in the Caribbean literature. And I'm looking at your novel, and then I'm thinking of, you know, Sylvia Winter, I think she's 97 years old. but just talk about, I mean, you've made a tremendous contribution. And I'm thinking of Sylvia Winter. I'm thinking of Lorna Goodison, who was poet laureate before you. Talk about what's happening in terms of women in the Caribbean.
Yeah. Well, women, and I do have a book called Women in the Caribbean, which it's a bit old, but it was based on scholarly research on the status of women. And what we find is women in the Caribbean are powerful in some ways. If you go into a lot of the big companies, say, in Jamaica are now run by women, including our leading bank and so on. And women are powerful, visibly powerful, and yet, as we know, in many ways are not powerful. And that is because of the structure of the society. And a lot of the structure of the society in, let us say, Jamaica, is based on traditions brought from Africa, because a significant portion of the population is of African ancestry. And we know that in African societies, in some, women are also very powerful, you know, and some of that was brought where the women bear the brunt of child rearing of the family and so on, and the men would go out to work. Well, what happened is that a lot of Caribbean women are both mothers and fathers, because the fathers neglect, not us, some, their responsibilities. And mothers bear the children, raise the children, also have to find the means to support the children, which truncates their opportunities. So on the one hand, you have all these educated women playing leading roles at all levels. We've had female prime ministers, Maya Motley in Barbados,
right,
powerful prime ministers. We have scholars like Sylvia Winter, writers, and so on. So at one level, you see this power out there. The women, you see the market women, the traders, etc., even dance hall culture now, women rule the roost. So there's that high visibility of women. But when you examine the lives of working class women, you're seeing a different story because of the burden that's placed on women to provide for their families, you know? And so it's like everything else, it's two-sided. We're seeing both.
Let me bring in a statement by Sybil Winter and ask you how this statement might relate to your own work, Olive Senior. Sybil once said, folklore is not only the relation of man to nature, but of man to himself. Folklore is the guerrilla resistance against the market economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I knew Sylvia and edited her. I used to edit Jamaica Journal, and maybe that's from. But I absolutely agree with her. And I'm giving a lecture later this month, I mean, in September, about sort of that, about the book, what we read, and how the book commands society, you know, words, language, versus what she called in folklore, I call it oral culture, what we learn from the ground up. And that is, it's something that engages me in my own nonfiction work, fiction, poetry, and everything. This challenge between what we're told and the power of the book and what we learn intuitively through ancestral memories, through what we learn from experience. I grew up in rural Jamaica, so I know a lot of folklore because that was my culture at the time.
How important is Louise Bennett?
Oh, absolutely. Louise Bennett, there's a move afoot to make her a national hero, and I hope it happens, because what she did was opened up the door to our Jamaican language. Because as Jamaicans, we were bilingual. We're taught English in schools, we speak English, but our language at home for many people still is what they call patois. But it was banned. When I went to high school, we were punished if we were heard speaking patois on the streets. You know, it was that we were being brought up to be little English ladies and gentlemen. But the majority of people speak patois. And Louise Bennett was the one who broke that barrier and said, I am going to talk in my language. I'm going to write in my language. And it was a challenge to people at first. But she made that breakthrough. And she enabled people like me, Lorna Goodison, all of us as writers, to then use patois or be bilingual in our lives, in our language. And now, if you come to Jamaica, you hardly hear English spoken. And there's a way in which there's an orthography now, because it's people want to teach it in schools, and it's spelled a certain way, the Cassidy orthography. And much to people's shock, recently there was a billboard for a church, Jehovah's Witness, and all of it was written in Jamaican patois in this orthography. So people say, you know, our language has arrived, and the mother of that language is Louise Bennett, and we
You know, in our country, in the United States right now, there are quite a number of poet laureates. You were the poet laureate in Jamaica from 2021 to 2024. What did you do?
Well, each poet laureate is, you know, we decide on our program. The whole idea is to bring poetry to, you know, engage people with poetry. So that was done in various ways. And my main interest is the environment and talking about the environment. So we had a number of events and so on. There were, you know, we celebrate National Poetry Day. I did a number of things.
Who selects the Poet Laureate of Jamaica?
Pardon?
Who selects the Poet Laureate?
Oh, okay. It's based in the National Library, and The poet laureate is, people are invited to suggest names, and then, you know, you have to qualify by, of course, having a certain number of publications out there, having a certain kind of reputation, and people suggest names, and a vote is taken, a secret vote, by a poet laureate committee, which is made up, you know.
A secret, and there's a little smoke that emerges up from the Vatican.
Almost. I mean, I have no idea, because I was just I just received a phone call and said, will you accept? but it's a great honor. And each poet laureate does. I've done a book which actually has just come out called Tree Scene, and it's poems about trees with photographs, which I hope will convince people that a tree is not something standing out there waiting to be cut down, but it is the very air we breathe, you know. So that's my final contribution. But I did a number of events. We had a lot of events.
Hmm. What is your relationship with Kwame Joyce? He's a new poet laureate of Jamaica.
Kwame is a new poet laureate. He's also a professor in the States. And Kwame is the founder of the Calabash Literary Festival in Jamaica, which, you know, is big. And he's very, and of course, he was born in Africa to Jamaican father. So he's also big in terms of African, encouraging African literature publications. So he's a global figure.
What about the other person who returns every now and then, Linton Kwesi Johnson?
Oh, Linton, yeah. He's somebody we adore. He in England. Mm-hmm. And Linton comes to Calabash every year. So, and he's a major figure. I mean, obviously in poetry.
Are people still doing dub poetry?
Oh yeah, it's now, I would say, spoken word, mm-hmm. which includes dub and other forms, is very, very popular among the young people. And so I would say it's more popular now than published poetry. Though a lot of the dub poets, like Linton, also publish books. And it's not just in Jamaica, you know, it's in Trinidad and Barbados. Spoken word poetry is very popular as mm-hmm. well. So I like that because I take a very democratic view of poetry, you know. So I like the idea that poetry is such an accessible art form. You don't even need a pencil to write poetry. If you have a mouth, mm-hmm. you can write poetry. And I think poetry is what changes the world because mm-hmm. it cannot be controlled. Dictator, right. No matter what they do, the word is going to come out.
How popular is Bob Marley still in Jamaica in terms of his influence on literature?
He's more influential, I think, on the music still in terms mm-hmm. of young musicians right. and so on. It's the influence on the thing is Bob Marley came out of the same space that people like myself, Lorna Goodison, our generation mm-hmm. came out of that moment.
Right.
When Jamaica is opening up.
That's like a Michael Manley moment.
Right. Yeah. Our culture was opening up mm-hmm. through the music, the researchers, the people researching the music, dance, art, all of it. It was that moment. And so all of us use, say, folklore. A lot of Bob Marley's music incorporates sayings that we all knew. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the younger singers will use those sayings without knowing where they're coming from. Right. They say, you know. So I think Bob Marley is just influential because people see him almost as a prophet, as mm-hmm. somebody who took the music and the language and the Rasta message of peace mm-hmm. around the world. And it's a message we need today. So,
you know, when you say that Rasta message of peace, and we're getting to the end of our show, I also think of another person who I really admired was Walter Rodney and yes. grounding with his brothers when he's meeting with the Rasta family. I think that's so important in terms of us who are doing political work, grassroots work.
Yes. And we were talking about Walter Rodney and, you know, and the work he did here. But all of this, Marley, the musicians, Rodney, Sylvia Winter, the intellectuals, the art, all of these came out of that moment.
And you have been at the center of this movement.
No,
you know what happened? You know, I remember you know, I think it was in the 70s when I got a sense of who you were, you know, but I feel that you're very, very important. That's why I'm so glad that you took time out to be a guest on my program because I always admired you.
Thank you. Well,
now, Lorna Goodison, now she's another problem. But I love Lorna. You're right. Kwame, I adore. Kwame, I just think I'm the best. I mean, he's just a phenomenal individual. So I want to thank you, Olive Sr. And I hope that, you know, this book, Paradise Once, creates new audiences for you, new readers, because it's a very important book and a very well-written book. So my guest today has been Olive Sr. She's the author of Paradise Once. She's also with the Port Laureate of Jamaica from 2021 to 2024. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Brazilian nonprofit Educarte presents a night of Afro-Brazilian culture with Ile Aie percussion and dance ensemble from Liberdade Salvador, Brazil, celebrating its 50th anniversary with a return to Washington, D.C. on Friday, September 5th, 8 p.m. at the UDC Theater of the Arts at 4200 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. Their performances feature drumming, songs that tell the stories of resistance and hope, and dances inspired by the orishas and traditions of candomblé. Details about this Afro-Brazilian celebration in D.C. featuring Ile Aie at educarteinc.org, educarteinc.org, or 202-450-8541.
Karan Dance Company celebrates its 42nd annual National African Dance and Drum Conference, Coming Together as One, on Labor Day weekend from Friday, August 29th to Sunday, August 31st. The conference workshops will take place at the Washington Marriott Capitol Hill and will be taught by 20-plus master dancers and drummers from Senegal, Mali, Guinea, Liberia, and the Republic of Congo. This year's concert performance will take place on August 31st at 8 p.m. at Howard University's Crampton Auditorium and will feature guest artists from across the U.S. and Khan Karan's company and community class family. Details can be found at www.khankoran.org. That's KanKouran.org. Or by calling 202-518-1213. WPFW, where we are changing the world, one broadcast and one community event at a time.
WPFW presents Labor Standing in Solidarity, Monday, September 1st. A day of programming centering the concept of collective action and mutual support among workers to achieve common goods and protect their interests, turning rights into reality. We will also offer analysis of labor's role in global inequity, imperialism, and genocide. From 9 a.m. until 3 p.m., hosts Julian Malveaux, Joni Eisenberg, Elise Bryan and Chris Garlock, and Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash bring you the voices of workers and those organizing throughout the labor movement. From 3 until 11 p.m., we offer a sonic reflection of labor in solidarity provided by our all-women DJ collective meeting in the ladies' room. Workers' rights are human rights on your station for jazz and justice. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you ready to move, groove, and exercise with the WPFW family? WPFW's annual 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness happens Saturday, September 13th from 8 a.m. till 1 p.m. This fundraiser will be held at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland. In addition to a scenic 5K trail, Fitness and wellness classes will be offered. Lively music to fuel your participation in the activities, along with water and healthy snacks, will be provided. Details are at WPFWFM.org or call 202-888-5484. There's something for everyone to enjoy. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Rev Yearwood, the host of Climate Friday. On Friday, August 29th, 9 a.m. until 7 p.m., we present From the Ninth Ward to the Airwaves, commemorating the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Produced by the Hip Hop Caucus in partnership with WPFW, our programming will highlight the community organizing being done in its wake, unpack the ongoing